Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. This summer, the focus was on Tokyo, the site of the Olympics and the Paralympics. Six athletes with ties to Connecticut competed in the Paralympics, and four of them brought medals home. Shortly after the competition ended, I spoke to paraswimmer Matthew Torres, who won a bronze medal in the 400-meter freestyle. We're re-airing my conversation with Torres during a week when we're featuring our best conversations of the year. Coming up, we'll also hear from his coach at Fairfield University. The school has an integrated swim team and has had other Paralympic swimmers in its program. And later, we'll talk with another athlete with Connecticut ties, para rower Laura Goodkind. Did you watch the Tokyo Paralympics? You can join us. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Matthew Torres joins us now on Zoom. Matthew, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you so much for having me this morning. I'm really grateful to be here today to be able to talk with you.
Now, you'll be starting your junior year at Fairfield, Matthew?
Yes, that's correct.
So what's it like having a bronze medal?
It feels good knowing that after all these years of hard work and dedication, over 13 years of it, it finally pays off. And this amazing experience that all came together in Tokyo. And it feels good knowing that with all the work that you put in, you finally you're able to get a reward from it, and so it's a good feeling.
You mentioned 13 years to get to this moment. So as a child, how did you get into swimming, Matthew?
I originally got into swimming back in 2008, watching Michael Phelps at the Summer Olympic Games in Beijing, smashing world records. And it was probably within a week after those Olympics ended that I joined a local swim club and started training. Mm.
So tell me your parents' reaction when you said, I want to swim. I want to be like Michael Phelps.
They were extremely supportive of me. They knew that whatever I needed to do to get to that level, that I would be dedicated to it. And so they didn't let anything hold me back. They encouraged me, they supported me, and whatever it is I needed for training, whether it was gear, moral support, help at competition, whatever it was, they were there for me.
So after you told them you wanted to start swimming, what happened next? Where did you go to begin your training, Matthew?
So I began my swimming career in the Valley YMCA in my hometown in Ansonia. Unfortunately, that Valley YMCA is no longer there. It closed down this past summer, but yeah, that's where I originally started my career, and it was a special place for me. And then from then on, I swam for a few other swim clubs, and now I'm here with the university training hard with Coach Tony.
I love hearing that you started at the YMCA. So many children learn to swim at the Y, including my kids, Matthew. What was the experience like? Were there other kids with disabilities on the swim team? How would you describe that experience?
So with the Valley YMCA Splinters, I was the only disabled swimmer there. And starting up, it was a little bit of a challenge. You know, I mean, I was 7 years old at the time, and I'm the only kid in there with one leg, so everyone else has a pretty sizable advantage over me. And again, my parents supported me, and they told me that no matter what is going on around me in practice. What matters is that my times were improving and that I was consistently getting faster. And I think that's what kept me on the right track. But overall, I made friends there in the Valley program, and I'm happy and grateful for the years I spent there.
Give us an idea of what training is like to be at the level that you're at, Matthew. I mean, how many hours a day are you in the pool?
Typically, roughly 3 to 4 hours of training every day, whether it be just in the pool or in the weight room, some sort of combination in between that. And I'm swimming 6 days a week. For now, just trying to get back into the groove of things, having just returned from Tokyo. But soon enough, I'll be swimming twice a day.
You're hearing Matthew Torres here on Where We Live. He's a bronze medalist at the Paralympics and a junior at Fairfield University. It was your first Paralympics, Matthew?
Yes, this was my first Games, and hopefully there's many more to come.
So can you tell us what it's like to be on the world stage? I mean, we're watching at home or on our computers, but when you're competing, and just take us back to when you were getting ready for the 400-meter freestyle. What was going through your mind?
For me, especially for the final, I knew I was in a big spot. You know, I was the number one seed going into finals, and I had this sort of confidence in me that I was going to have a good race. But at the same time, I knew that I needed to remain calm, not let any nerves get to me, because I had done the work and I'd done all the training and everything that needed to be done to get to that point. And so for me, it was just staying focused, staying calm, because I knew I could put together a good race, and ultimately that's what I did.
You mentioned that Michael Phelps inspired you, and I understand you met him before you got to the Paralympics, but did you see him while you were competing? What's he like?
So I did not see Phelps over in Tokyo, but I met him back in early 2019 Southern Connecticut State University, where he gave a speech. Our interaction was pretty brief, but I remember getting some words of encouragement from him and some support. He told me that he was looking forward to watching me race in Tokyo, and hopefully he got to see some of those races.
You know, it's interesting that you were talking about when you were seven watching Michael Phelps, and now other children are watching you, Matthew. How does that make you feel? What words of encouragement do you have for them?
I think it's pretty surprising just seeing like how things change over time. I mean, you start out being inspired by someone, and then eventually you turn into the person that's inspiring others, and I think that's really special, and it makes me happy to know that there's people that are being encouraged and motivated by what I do in the pool, and honestly for them that they made a big step taking that first progress into getting into sports, whether it be swimming or something else, and that to get to a high level like this, it takes a lot of work and dedication and focus. So just make sure that always have like that goal in mind and never take your eyes off the prize, because I think that's definitely what's going to drive you the most to succeed and stay in the game.
You're listening to Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. My guest, Matthew Torres, a bronze medalist at the Paralympics in Tokyo. He's a junior at Fairfield University. I wanted to bring into the conversation Matthew's coach, Anthony Bruno. He's the head coach of men's and women's swimming and diving at Fairfield. Anthony, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, congratulations to you as well. You must be so proud of Matthew Torres.
No, I mean, what Matthew's done over the last 2 years has been pretty incredible. You know, coming in as a first year, taking everything head on, and he really elevated himself over the last 2 years to get to where he is right now. So it's pretty inspiring.
Now, you've also had another Paralympian that you coached, Colleen Young. So tell me about the Fairfield program and what it's like to have two Paralympians now in the school's program.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. You know, my first exposure to para swimming was I had a college teammate back at Springfield College by the name of Justin Zook, you know, who went on to win gold medals, and he was kind of my first exposure to it. And then, you know, when I had the opportunity, when I took over Fairfield, I was very open to the idea and wanting to know more and wanting to do more. And, you know, it started with Colleen, and she went on to do a lot of exciting things. And I think that really opened the door for Matthew, and, you know, it made it easy for him to step right in and keep building on the success he had.
So when we think about the swim teams at Fairfield being integrated, so athletes with disabilities and athletes without, you know, how do you, any technical adaptations that are required during swim practice, how do you coach both?
Yeah, I mean, we really focus on what people can do, not what they can't do, right? So, you know, Matthew just got out of this water this morning. We had a big kick set, obviously, with one leg. So we were using fins. So that's, you know, just a basic adaptation of what we're doing. So to integrate into the kick sets and things like that. So, but yeah, I mean, we just talk about what we can do, and then we make adjustments off of that.
Matthew, I mentioned Colleen Young. What was that like to start at Fairfield, knowing that she was also part of the team? Was she also a role model for you?
Yeah, obviously, it was great having Colleen there for my first year here at Fairfield, knowing that we shared the U.S. Paralympic program, and that we were likely heading in to Tokyo together. It was great having her around, and I loved having an extra Paralympic teammate on the team. And we often train together, and we put in the work just along with everyone else. And I was able to actually spend some more time with her out in Colorado Springs over the last year training for Tokyo. The last 2 years with Colleen have been very special, and I think that being with her just really gave me a ground or a path to move in the right direction, and knowing that she was able to go through the entire Fairfield program, I think it gives me a little bit more confidence in myself and being here as well.
Coach Bruno, you mentioned that you like to focus on what people can do, not what they can't do. Both Colleen Young and Matthew are A-level swim team nationally. Michael Phelps was on the A-team when he was swimming competitively. So can you talk about the mindset, the attitude that a swimmer needs to get to the A-team?
Yeah, I mean, when Matthew got here, I mean, and Matthew, correct me if I'm wrong, I think we were on the developmental or C team at that point. So Matt was really, really coming on, and, you know, he kind of saw Colleen as being on that A team and a vision of where he wanted to be. And he was always communicating, asking, you know, what can I do? What can I do different? What can I do better? But, you know, he really, really kind of latched on to Colleen and saw where she was on the A team. And, you know, coming in at one level, by the end of his freshman year, I mean, he was really knocking on the door of being at that A level. And it really was just a lot of grit, a lot of hard work. Again, he just, he brings a great attitude to every workout. And it's really, you know, if they say that's the secret to success, I mean, just his general attitude every day in workouts is, I think a big reason he's had the success he's had.
You know, today we're talking about the Paralympics, and I wanted to bring up, you know, earlier this year, Toyota released an ad featuring 23-time Paralympic medalist, swimmer and double amputee Jessica Long, and it focused on her adoption story from Siberia and then becoming a double amputee because of a medical condition. Colin Young tweeted when that ad came out, I believe at the Super Bowl, that this ad is one of the biggest things to happen for the Paralympic movement in the U.S. I just wanted to play a portion of it for our listeners.
Mrs. Long?
Yes?
We've found a baby girl for your adoption, but there are some things you need to know. She's in Siberia, and she was born with a rare condition. Her legs will need to be amputated. I know this is difficult to hear. Her life, it won't be easy. Mrs. Long?
It might not be easy, but it'll be amazing. I can't wait to meet her.
I wanted to play that ad. I know many of us saw it also watching the Olympics and Paralympics. But Matthew, can you respond to what Colleen Young had tweeted about just the fact that, you know, the Paralympic movement is getting more attention and how you felt when you saw that ad?
Yeah, I mean, I saw that ad get aired for the first time during the Super Bowl as well, just as long as with everyone else there, we had like a small little get together for Jessica. And so we all watched that ad together, and it was a very special moment. Because just like Colleen said, that was monumental for the Paralympic movement as a whole. You know, the Paralympics have been getting a lot of momentum lately, a lot of publicity, and I think that's good because the people need to see that there's more to sports than, you know, just the Olympics. I mean, the Paralympics follow right after, and that's its own showcase of a lot of years of dedication and hard work across several different athletes, several different nations, and with all sorts of disabilities. And it's just, we're out there showing the world that we're at the same level right there with the Olympians.
Well, Matthew Torres, it's been a pleasure to hear from you, to learn a little bit about your story. I have to ask, now that you have the bronze, I mean, where do you keep it in your house? Do you walk around with it sometimes? Do you wear it?
it's with me here in Fairfield in my dorm room. I keep it in the case they gave me for it. But yeah, from time to time, I like to take it out and admire it.
Well, you have a lot to be proud of. And what's next for you, Matthew?
Next up for me, I'm focusing on the collegiate season and getting ready to go. Hopefully score some points in our dual meets and just be the best swimmer I can be for the Stags.
Matthew Torres again. He's a para swimmer, a bronze medalist at this year's Paralympics in Tokyo, and a junior at Fairfield University. Matthew, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Also, Anthony Bruno, head coach of the men's and women's swimming and diving program at Fairfield University. A pleasure to hear from you as well.
Thank you so much for the time.
This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, we hear from another athlete with Connecticut ties who competed in the Paralympics. Share a comment on our Facebook page or find us on Twitter at Where We Live.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. A lot of people struggle with sleep apnea and with CPAP machines. Dr. Carl Muller, a head and neck surgeon with Hartford Hospital, describes Inspire, a surgical alternative to the CPAP approach.
Only about 60% of patients can tolerate CPAP real well. Inspire is a surgical alternative to CPAP. It's an outpatient surgery. It takes about 2 hours. And essentially what it does is it picks up when you're taking a breath and sends a 2-second electrical pulse to the tongue, which causes the tongue to stick out a little bit and stiffen and prevent the airway from collapsing.
Hartford Hospital has performed more than 200 Inspire therapy surgeries. If you've tried and failed with CPAP, you could be a candidate for this minimally invasive procedure.
Patients with moderate to severe sleep apnea are candidates. There is a weight criteria, so you have to have a body mass index below 35, and you have to have tried and failed CPAP.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
Join Connecticut Public and Fairfield County's Community Foundation for the In Community Speaker Series May 2nd, featuring New York Times Magazine journalist Nicole Hannah Jones, creator of the 1619 Project. Jones will talk about her work covering racial injustice and the legacy of slavery on our culture, our politics, and our institutions. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. at District Music Hall in Norwalk. Tickets at ctpublic.org/speaker-series. This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalbathanchel. We're talking about the Tokyo Paralympics today, which wrapped up just last week. 129 athletes on Team USA brought medals home. Four of them had Connecticut ties. Paralympian Laura Goodkind competed in the 2016 and 2020 games. She went to the Foreman School in Litchfield, and she lives now in California. She's joining us on Zoom. Laura, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Great to be here.
I mentioned you're a two-time Paralympian. Congratulations. What's that like on the world stage? I also had asked Matt the same question.
It's pretty incredible, especially that this year we had a lot of coverage because of the pandemic. So I think a lot more people were exposed than previous years. And so In a way, it was advantageous that we didn't have an audience because it did allow for more media coverage and for more people to be reached worldwide to view us.
So you're a para rower. So tell me about your competition.
So the categories or the race length?
Your categories.
Okay, so we have a PR1, PR2, and PR3. I'm a PR2, so that's the middle impairment class. Most rowers in that class have a bilateral leg impairment.
And so when you were just born, doctors told your family that you may not walk or talk. And I'd like to talk a little bit with you about, how you got into rowing and a little bit about, the time and commitment that you put in to become a Paralympian, Laura.
Right. So I had a lot of medical complications from the get-go. I was born 3 months early. And so when it was in my mid-20s that I became aware of the Paralympic movement, and then I would say in my late 20s is when I was seeing a dietitian for a swallowing disorder that I had, and I had become really sick in 2014. I had sepsis and septic shock, and so I nearly died in 2014, and I was living abroad then, and when I came back to the U.S., seeing this dietitian, she thought it would be a really good idea for me to be with other people who also experience a physical challenge. And so I thought, okay, there are sports and there are support groups, and that's all that I was aware of at the time for what was available for people with a physical difference. And I chose sports, but she was very hesitant. She thought that it was not a good idea. My vitals were not stable, but I found rowing through a Paralympic sport club search. And it was realized very early on that me being involved in sports was actually improving my health. And so the more active I was becoming, the more stable my vitals were becoming. And that was my initial introduction into the world in my late 20s.
So you have cerebral palsy, and you mentioned you got, encouraged and introduced to pararowing. So tell us what it was like to start in your 20s.
Fortunately, I was very active for as soon as I could walk. I was in pretty much every sport imaginable. And so though I hadn't done rowing, I did still have the athletic confidence to pursue something at a high level. When I was at the Foreman School, I was on 3 different sports teams, and I was competing like first singles in tennis from my freshman year at a different school, but it continued at the Foreman School. And so the transition into rowing was more a technical shift than it was an athletic shift, because that mindset was already there from the get-go.
I mentioned you're a 2-time Paralympian. So can you contrast your time in 2016 to your time this year, Laura?
Sure. The primary difference, which was incredible, was that in 2016, with the Russian doping scandal, I found out 10 days before heading to processing that we were offered the spot for the Russians that we had lost the spot to in a previous competition that year. And so that was a whirlwind. That was just, hey, would you like to go to Rio? Okay, 10 days, you're going. So that there was not a ton of mental preparation for that. This time was a lot different. We earned our spot at the World Championships. We earned the boat spot in 2019 at the World Championships. And so the boat acts as a placeholder, and then you have to earn your spot at U.S. Trials the following year. That was postponed because of the pandemic, but in Trials this year in April, we earned the spot. And so there was a lot more mental and physical preparation that went into these games.
When we think about being an athlete at your level, I mean, there's a lot, like you mentioned, having like a certain mental and physical, ability to keep competing and to practice and be consistent. But there were times in your life that this helped you. I understand that you were homeless at one point. Can you talk about that and you know, how being involved in sports has helped you?
Sure. So it was actually after I returned from my very first developmental camp in Boston that I basically, when the plane landed in LA, I had someone call me saying that the housing I was living at was no longer going to be available. And it was virtually overnight that I became homeless. And I experienced homelessness for nearly 2 years in Santa Monica. I was at a decent shelter, but truth be told, most people would alter their realities using drugs or alcohol. And that, you know, was an option for me, but I decided I would rather manage my reality. And that's where sports were integral. And so people might be out doing what they were doing at night, and I would be late for curfew because like the train broke down and I didn't make it in time. And so it was a frustrating challenge to be like, I'm engaging in healthy activities. I don't understand why there's negative repercussions for that. But definitely sports and the community that I found in the adaptive sports community, those people were phenomenal and kind of just gave me that outlet that I certainly needed during those years. And I was still homeless when I was competing in Rio. So it was definitely a world shift to be living in a shelter than to be in a Paralympic Olympic village with elite athletes. That was definitely a major transition going to and leaving from the village that year. Fortunately, I secured housing in May 2017 and been housed since then.
And you're doing all right now, Laura?
Yes, a really great organization, Brilliant Corners. They've been subsidizing, affording me a grant so that way I can remain housed in spite of any medical limitations that I might have, because that was the primary reason that I became homeless to begin with, because I had so many medical complications that I couldn't hold down a full-time job. And so this organization definitely helps remove that stressor from my life.
What do you want people to know about what it means to be a Paralympian, to compete at this level of the Paralympics? Do you think there's more awareness of the games now?
I think there's definitely more, thanks to, in large part, the media and all the promotions that were leading up to Tokyo, especially compared to Rio. I think it's incredible that one thing I definitely didn't know as a little kid, I wasn't aware that there was such a thing as an adaptive sport community, or that even that I would qualify with my disability. I do have cerebral palsy, but I was always brought up like as though I were able-bodied. And I would like a lot of people out there to know that like almost any physical disability that's permanent, that limits you in some way, could make you eligible for a sport in the Paralympics. It might not be, you know, the one that you're competing in right now, but there will be a sport out there for almost everyone who wants to find one. And so get involved as young as possible. And don't let like labels limit you. We all have labels and we all have situations, but we can definitely rise above those. We don't have to be defined by them.
It's been a pleasure to hear from you, Laura. What's next for you after Tokyo?
Thank you so much. I'm going to still be staying very active. And it might be rowing, it might be another sport, but I'm definitely looking forward to competing in Paris, hopefully, in 3 years.
That's Laura Goodkind again. She's a 2-time Paralympian, and she has Connecticut roots. She went to the Foreman School in Litchfield. Laura, thanks again.
Thank you.
I wanted to transition to Maggie Vannoni, who's with us here on Zoom. She's a sports reporter for Hearst, Connecticut. Maggie, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me, Laura. I'm happy to be here. Or Lucy, I'm happy to be here.
It was interesting to hear Laura's story. And I wonder if you can tell us more about the para-athletes who competed with ties to Connecticut.
Yeah, there were 6 athletes who competed in Tokyo in the Paralympics with ties to Connecticut, a couple of them being local and born here in the state, and others having connections through colleges or high school.
Can you tell us more about them and how diverse were they in terms of their sport and their disabilities?
Yeah, we had 2 swimmers with Matthew and Colleen, both University of Fairfield swimmers, both of which medaled as well. And then we also had Karen Petrick from Glastonbury, who medaled in the PR3 mixed for Cox and rowing event. Team USA won silver in that event for the 7th straight year. We also had Lovar Goodkind, who we just heard from, and Amy Dixon in the para triathlon, and Brianna Salinero in the para taekwondo event. Mm.
I understand the Paralympics saw many firsts this year in terms of equity. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, this Paralympics was one of the most inclusive Paralympics, if not that we've had so far. Besides just an increase in viewership, an increase in hours broadcast. The NBC broadcasted over 1,200 hours compared to just 70 hours during the Rio Games in 2016. Additionally, we saw a lot of equity in prize reward and money reward with medals. Paralympians who medaled won the exact same amount that Olympians who medaled in their counterparts. For example, if a Paralympian won a gold medal, they're originally, in 2016, they would just get $7,500 for that medal. But now in 2020, they got $37,500, which is a 400% increase.
Wow. And so what were some of the catalysts for that?
Yeah, I think a lot of that just had to do with trying to make it an even playing field, because it is, you know, because these Paralympians work just as hard to earn their spot in these summer games as their Olympic counterparts. And that decision to make the prize reward equal was passed originally in 2018. And this was the first Olympic Games to put that into action.
You know, when we think about, I asked both athletes that I spoke with about just awareness of the Paralympics, and they do believe that it's growing. Would you say that's the case, Maggie?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that just comes with, you know, companies like Toyota highlighting these athlete stories, along with having more access to watching the games, with NBC showing more hours. It introduces people to these athletes, to these types of sports. And I think that's the most important part.
So what will happen to the Paralympics? You know, we've heard through the years just the outcry generally against the costs of the Olympics. And, you know, again, it's the same the site and location for the Paralympics. The Tokyo Olympics official price tag was $15 billion. That's more than the GDP of small countries. And so has there been conversation about that at all?
I think we're still going to see them going on as planned. I know Each Olympic Games, including the Paralympics, usually go over price budget as well. I know Beijing coming up for the Winter Games in February for the Winter Paralympic and Olympic Games. I know that's probably we might see that also go over budget, just dealing with more COVID postponements, how to make sure all the health and safety guidelines are being met, but most likely will increase the budget as well.
Before I let you go, Maggie, I did want to ask about the Fairfield University Integrated Swim Program. Again, you got two Paralympians coming out of Fairfield, Colleen Young and Matthew Torres. Is the program fairly unique?
Yeah, I would say so. I would also say, you know, that we're seeing more Division I programs across the country just incorporating different levels of swimmers, different swimmers, and saying, hey, we want to help you reach your goals, whether those are para goals, whether those are collegiate goals. We want to do what we can to help you succeed. I think that's just really inspiring to see these historical programs reaching out and saying, come swim for us and let's help you elevate your para goals.
You're hearing Maggie Vannoni here on Where We Live. She's a sports reporter with Hearst, Connecticut. Maggie, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up right after the break, we wanted to learn more about sports training programs for children and adults with intellectual disabilities. Coming up, we'll hear from Special Olympics Connecticut. You can join us too. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Now, earlier we were talking to Paralympians with ties to Connecticut after the games wrapped up in Tokyo. We wanted to learn more about the sports training opportunities for children and adults with intellectual disabilities in our state. Joining us now on Zoom is Bo Dougherty, president of Special Olympics Connecticut. Bo, welcome to the show.
Great to be on, Lucy.
Now, we were just talking about the integrated swim team at Fairfield University, and I understand through Special Olympics Connecticut that school teams are also unified. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, 1992, Special Olympics Connecticut, we got together with CIAC, and we developed what we call unified sports in the school systems. Unified sports came out of Massachusetts. It's essentially sports where kids with and without disabilities are all on the same team. And presently 95% of all the high schools, 82 middle schools, and about 70 elementary schools are doing unified sports and have been doing it for a long time in about 6 different sports during the course of the school year.
That's an impressive percentages. Talk about the value of this program.
The end game, I would say that, and most people would agree, and the research shows, we're trying to move the needle for non-disabled people to accept people with differences. We all are aware of, you know, the old days where a lot of our athletes would sit in the corner at lunchtime, you know, never be asked to go to a party. A lot of that has changed because a lot of these non-disabled kids had been practicing and then competing together with the athletes. And, you know, some misconceptions that they may have has been overturned by the fact that they, you know, they practice as a team. And then when they go to the state competitions or the local tournaments, they're going against other unified teams. So they bond together.
You mentioned misconceptions. I'm also thinking about in the school climate when children may be different from others, they can get bullied. And how do you see unified sports helping squash that?
It helps a lot. We don't. Sometimes I'll hear specific things that have happened, but a lot of the partners on our teams, let's just say, discourage that from happening within the school systems. That's been shown by research. You know, at our level four unified program, if you can envision this, you'd have modified height of baskets and basketball. And it's the captain of the football team that's helping that person with a physical disability and an intellectual disability get from one end of the court to the other, and the captain of the field hockey team. And when you have those sorts of people within the high school framework who are doing things with our athletes, it does change the game. People don't want to do bad things to our athletes.
You're hearing Bo Doherty here on Where We Live. He's president of Special Olympics Connecticut, talking about the training opportunities for children and adults with intellectual disabilities in our state. You know, I remember Special Olympics back when I was in high school and volunteered. I imagine it has changed a lot through the years. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's changed a ton, honestly, Lucy. You know, now, you know, there's a lot of effort put into the health and fitness side of the house. If you came to our summer games, there would be screenings for everything from feet to ears. I mean, if somebody's got problems after a test with their eyesight, we grind the glasses right then and there. We have dentists and hygienists doing the screening. And then we have the ability to send people to different doctors and hospitals across the state if they've got some real problems there. So health has really changed. The inclusive nature of the whole organization has changed. What we started in 92 here is now in at least 90% of all the US programs, and the Department of Education is supporting efforts in unified sports in schools across the United States. And most recently, in this particular year, there's a huge push put on the urban areas of Connecticut. One school in Connecticut system that we had just not done a very good job with is Hartford, and we have two high schools coming on with us this year. But every other urban area of Connecticut is covered. Mm.
You mentioned the origin of the Unified program starting back in the 90s, but I understand that Eunice Kennedy Shriver helped you launch this, right? Can you talk about that?
Sure. So I went to Eunice Kennedy Shriver in 1984 and told her that I felt very strongly that if we didn't change philosophically as an organization and start to put our athletes on teams with non-disabled individuals, that we would become outdated in the next 10 years. And luckily for me, that did resonate. You know, Mrs. Shriver did sailing with her sister, Rosemary, who was intellectually disabled, and they were a really great team, you know, racing down in Hyannisport. And she was a very strong leader. And when she finally did a little bit of research, we did a bunch of tournaments with about five different states. She got up there in front of everybody and said, "This program is something that I really believe in, and I want you all to start going down this road." And I'll tell you, Lucy, there are a lot of programs around the world and a lot of states who did not want to go down that road, but they're all doing it now.
Tell me about that, the pushback that, at least in the beginning.
I think the pushback was that people could not grasp, they were afraid that non-disabled people would take the limelight on the teams. I also think that some people just could not fathom why you would just not put all your efforts into only putting people with disabilities or differences on the same team. They could not understand the end game, which is really the friendship and acceptance and relationship building that sometimes sports has. You know, we often talk, you know, it's unbelievable what Matthew and Laura have done. Incredible. you know, some of our athletes are severely challenged. And so, you know, the gold medal at the highest levels may not come about, but having some friends in your life is pretty important.
If you're listening now and you have a connection to Special Olympics Connecticut, we'd love to hear from you. 888-720-9677 or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. You know, we were talking about some of the pushback in the beginning with the unified program. And I'm wondering, when we think about the challenges that remain, Bo, for you and your team, you know, trying to run these programs, especially in a pandemic.
Yeah, you know, we've come off virtual, but the great news is that we just had over 900 athletes, starting with bocce down in Stanford, all the way to Ocean House, where we had croquet, and we did sailing, we did softball and golf. We were able to do those sports after coming through a winter where we were doing pretty much everything virtually. So every state is in a different situation, Special Olympics right now. So Texas is not, can't do any practices. They can't do any competitions. Connecticut is in a different boat. Maine's starting to close down a little bit. Rhode Island was having some difficulties. So all of us are really, our athletes are very isolated. They're in a residential program with their parents. And, you know, for them, our program has been a social program. So, you know, we're all really trying to open things up and get sports happening where we can do it in person. You know, Coach Bruno hosted us recently in the summer, where we had all our swimmers. Luckily, we were able to go to Fairfield University. So we're hoping that that translates into some things in the holiday season where we can do bowling, powerlifting, unified volleyball, and unified basketball.
For people listening now who might be interested in getting someone in their family involved, you know, what's a good way to start?
Best way to start is really to go to our website, www.soct.org. That is the best way to start, because once we get the email or once we get the phone call, we can then work with a parent or an athlete to get them connected to one of the 72 local training programs that we have, or if they're young, get them connected to our school program with CIAC.
That's wonderful to hear. And earlier you had mentioned, you know, trying to get some programs in urban areas has been a challenge, but you're starting one up in Hartford. Also relying a lot on volunteers, Bo?
Yeah, that's been our lifeblood. I mean, that is the thing that has made Special Olympics a little bit different. We've been able to get a lot of corporations to come out, employee activation. They see the end result of where their money goes. And so that has been a big thing. So volunteering is incredibly important. We were, as an example with Ocean House and croquet, we had everybody all set, except we didn't have drivers for shuttles. And the Navy saved us at the last second. So having all different types of volunteers with different skills, we need them in our organization. And without them, we'd be in tough shape.
Mm. So they can go to that same website to learn more, to volunteer, Bo.
Absolutely, yes.
Can you say it again for us?
Yeah, sure. It's www.soct.org.
And we'll be sure to share that on our social media. Well, it was a pleasure to talk with you, Bo. We know Special Olympics does such amazing work. And when you think about the unified sports model that started here and now replicated nationally, that's a lot to be proud of.
Thank you, Lucy. And I've been listening to you for a long time, so it's really a big thing for me to be on your show. Thank you.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you, Bo. Today's show, produced by Sujatha Srinivasan. Our technical producer is Kat Pastor. You can listen to Where We Live anytime. Just download us on your favorite podcast app. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Back tomorrow.